Welcome to episode 25 of the Oxfordshire Teacher Training Podcast. My name is Matthew Coatsworth and I'm delighted to be sitting down today with Dr. Naira Wilson, who's a child clinical psychologist. And today we're going to be thinking about pupil mental health and also about managing transitions. So welcome, Naira.
Thanks very much, Matt. Nice to see you as always.
Obviously, this year has been unlike any other in terms of the kind of transitions that we've been dealing with and the challenges for everyone's mental health, but particularly for pupil mental health. So, Naira, before we kick in to look at one particular approach that you've been using, I just wonder what your thoughts are about what we can do as professionals within the world of education at the moment, thinking about getting ready for this. Hopefully we're about to broadcast this at the very beginning of the summer term in schools, as hopefully things start to open up a bit.
One of the things I do, Matt, is I often talk to children about how their brains are problem-solving machines. So when any of us are faced with new dilemmas, new situations, ultimately when we're in states of uncertainty, which is exactly what we're confronting at the moment, is huge amounts of uncertainty. What our brains want to do is they want to figure it all out to gain more certainty, to feel safe, to feel equipped. If we overthink things, if we are trying to problem solve problems that can't be solved some of the times or can't be solved quickly, that is where anxiety plays its role and we start to feel more anxious than we might like to. You know, ultimately what the brain's trying to do is trying to find solutions. One of the things we notice is that there is a difference between how children tolerate the feelings that come about with uncertainty. And some of us can just tolerate it better and we kind of find uncertainty a bit exciting and interesting and we're curious. And for others of us, uncertainty just causes huge amounts of worry and stress. So I suppose what teachers can do is to normalize it. That I know that's probably something everybody says all of the time, but really that this is a collective experience, and I'm hoping that the tool I talk about today really shows you about how we try and increase a community, really, that we're all trying to go through this.
Now, you've just mentioned there that there's a tool that you want to share with us today. So let's dig in a little bit more deeply about this. So this is a particular approach that you've been using to support mental health and transition. You base it around a house. So maybe do you want to just talk us through about what you do?
Okay. Well, Matt, the house analogy really, it came about many, many years ago as a way of documenting the journey that young people had been through in their therapy with me. And I used it as a transition tool for post therapy. It was their final session and it would be a chance to amalgamate all the things that they'd learned and a place to reflect on really on what their mental health has meant to them and how they've coped with it. So the tool in itself is not strategies as such. It's more facilitates a discussion so that young people can reflect on what they need for their mental health. What I ask children to do is to draw a house from the foundations upwards and to discuss the function of each element of the house that they're building. And, you know, how they would create a home within it, how would they want to live in it, what it takes to look after this home, what challenges might this home face, how do they protect it, how do they nurture it, how do they update it and modernise it. And as they embellish this drawing, what we then do at the end is kind of flip it over and say, well, now actually that house represents you. What would your foundations be to keep you shored up in life, for example? And we go through each of the different functions of the house, but to apply it to the young person. And I guess one of the hopes that I have about this analogy really is, yes, that it facilitates a conversation for children to think about what it takes to look after your well-being, all the different elements that make that up, because there isn't one clear thing that any of us have to do. It's very, very individual. And really to help them think about, well, what gets in the way as well of looking after our mental health, because there are many, many things that do that. But ultimately, I guess what I hope the tool does is it increases reflective capacity and gets children to really start talking and thinking about their emotional well-being rather than quickly coming to a solution or a strategy.
So unlike all of our podcasts so far, where it's all been entirely audio, there's going to be the option, if you want to actually see this being done.
Well, so Matt, let's start to build your home. In order to build a house, what do we need first?
the foundations. What's going to be at the bottom of the house? Okay. Going to make sure.
Lovely. So Matt, I've drawn the foundation. Tell me what the function of that foundation is for a home. What's its job?
So it's we're there with that foundation to make sure that everything is stable, and that we've also got a real rock that we can put everything else on.
Okay, so what do we build next, Matt?
So I think we probably need some walls in here now, don't we?
So again, Matt, what function do the walls serve for this home?
Two things spring to mind straight away. So one is protection.
Yeah.
So we've got, so around that includes things like safety and warmth. It creates a space that we call home, really, around it.
Right. And Matt, you're just going backwards a little bit. Yeah. What happens if the foundation's built on the wrong surface, or has been built too quickly, or with the wrong materials? What can happen to that foundation?
Well, I think if those foundations aren't stable and it's not there, then the worry is that actually the walls themselves aren't going to be stable, and that there's potential for this to all fall in.
So obviously then the next element is our roof. Sorry, it's not the best of drawings.
That's fine.
And again, so what function does the roof serve? What's its job?
Again, we've got that sense of it being protection as well. Yeah. And again, it's that idea of keeping things secure inside.
You know, you said earlier that once we've built these four walls, it makes a home.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a home and our shelter?
I think that the home has more than just you can have a shelter that anyone can go to, but the home is my home. It's my family's home. It's
right.
It's my space.
So there's something important about it being quite individual.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how do you make it really individual, Matt?
The objects inside the home, how I organise things.
Yeah. Why is it that you're wanting a space that's very individual? Why don't you have the same objects as everybody else in your street?
Because it's me. It's about my identity. It's about my, so for me, it's also my family's identity as well. And there's a whole section about why it's a home, is because it's not just my home, it's our home. But the our is our family.
Right.
And that's really important as well for me.
Right, so personalising it, decorating it, lighting it in a way that suits you and your family is really important.
Exactly.
And why aren't we pulled into wanting to have the same carpet as your neighbour, or the same colour walls? Why is it that we actually do really want to have an individual space?
We are all different, and so the things that matter to me aren't necessarily the things that would matter for you. And even within our house as well, so that the different rooms in our home, the different members of my family, have made their spaces different as well.
So there's something about a sanctuary for each and all of us, and a place to really explore our sense of self in that space. And somehow that's really allowed, isn't it, when we're in our homes. We almost encourage ourselves to put our own stamp and mark on it.
Yeah.
Matt, what happens if we start comparing our home to the mansions and the other people's homes around us?
That's a really interesting thing, because of course that then gets into the idea of do I then feel a sense of jealousy, or do I feel a sense of wanting things that I can't have? What do I do about that? Do I save up for it, or do I accept that I can't have it? Do I buy it even though I can't afford it?
Absolutely. So there's all these dilemmas that we have about accepting the home that we have and appreciating it versus wanting more, working towards things. Do I save and have them? Do I accept that I can't have them and live without?
Okay, with what I have got, how can I organise this in a way that helps me to feel? So for me, one of the things I really look for in my home is a sense of calm.
Mm-hmm.
I need that I need that space to be somewhere where I try not to feel that I'm creating stress in it. So for me, that means a tidy place. But I know that that's not the same for all the members of my family.
Yeah.
Who can cope with levels of chaos and clutter around them in very different ways.
So there's something really important here, that there's something about a collective experience as a family, but also that within your family there's quite individual styles and ways of coping with stresses, or how you like things. So this home needs to be able to to function for everybody, and manage all of our needs. So there's a lot of negotiation, I imagine, that happens within our homes, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And Matt, how do people need to behave in this home? How do we need to treat this house?
Well, I think that's a really important question to think about. You know, this is, you know, if we think about, I'm now, for the people who are listening rather than watching, Naira's drawn a picture of the house, and I can see all of the words that we've been talking about coming down there, and I can see that sense of it being a place that's secure and safe and calm, and it's got that sense of organisation appears in a number of places here. All these things are really, really important. I've got to try and make sure that I'm holding on to all of that, because if I don't hold on to that, then that can have an impact on how I feel as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what is it that we need to do to this home on a day-to-day basis to care for it?
We need to love this home. We need to make sure that we care for the home as well.
How do you do that literally, Matt?
So the people and the things within it, we treat with care. We definitely think about making sure that if something has a particular place, that we try and make sure it's in that place, so that it's got... Are we also sharing the space? And I think that's an important thing as well, is thinking about...
You know, it's really interesting. When I piloted this with some children from Wolvercote, one of the things that one of the children said to me was that they needed to treat their house with respect. And when we interrogated that a bit further, what she meant was, you know, people knowing what their tone is around the house, people not destroying stuff, not breaking things on purpose. You know, you said about caring for this environment. And I guess one of the things I'm curious about is, what is it that you appreciate then about this home that you've invested in, that you're caring for?
In the olden days, when people used to visit inside our home, that they would feel that they could share this home with us. So it was a place that I felt proud of. It was, you know, it was our sanctuary. This was our place where we could go to, and we could be ourselves, and we could feel that what the big challenges of what was around us, you know, we're dealing with that outside of our home, but within our home, mm-hmm. we're hoping that we've got a space where we can let all of those challenges just sit away from where we are.
Right. And so, talking about those challenges, Matt, what are they? What external factors could damage our homes, affect our homes, that are really out of our control?
You know, on a practical thing, it could be something like something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking about in the last year, we've had things like, you know, washing machines break down and mm-hmm. cause leaks.
And I guess things like weather conditions and...
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, over this last year or so, one of the other things is, how can we keep this space that we're spending more time in than perhaps we would choose to, mm-hmm. without our friends coming mm-hmm. and sharing it with us? How mm-hmm. how can we keep this place somewhere that keeps us happy as well?
Particularly when we just have ourselves and we can't rely on everybody mm-hmm. else to make us feel good or make us feel happy or to share difficult things with. There is something about nurturing our space, and what we're going to come to is ourselves. What about our neighbors, Matt? How do they affect our home?
Right.
What do our relationships need to be like?
So I need there needs to be a little bit of a disclosure here for
you need to be careful what you say, Matt.
Yes, so Naira and I are actually next door neighbors. One of the things that we really value about our neighbors is the fact that everyone looks out for each other. It's a really, really important part of being in our community is that we're aware of how people are
yes.
near us. We're thinking about each other. We help each other in different yeah. ways. And sometimes those ways can be really practical things like, you know, if somebody needs something to be got from the shops or something like that, then we can do that. But sometimes it can be really significant things as well.
And really what you're talking about, Matt, I guess, is being aware of those people around us
exactly.
and building that sense of community, getting to know people, from that peripheral level. But I guess what I heard in that also is there's something about compassion for each other's
exactly.
place in the world and in your street. Coming back to the home, what doesn't work very well? What could be better? What do we want to improve, or what can't be improved but we live with?
Obviously, one of the joys for me is that I share my home with my family. That's not always the case for everyone. But there has to be an element of compromise, because one of the challenges that I'm sure many people who've been living in houses with others have dealt with over the last year has been that sense of, actually, there are times when some people need quiet. There are times when sometimes people need space. And how can you deal with that? So, but also with that compromise goes that sense of that not everyone is going to be entirely happy all of the time. Mm. So it's thinking about which I don't want to use the word battles, but which battles are worth fighting and which ones are not. Mm-hmm. Which actually will cause more tension in our house than others.
But there are also elements in our homes that just can't be repaired. We can't fix them. What might they be, Matt? What are things that we just have to live with?
We can't easily fix things like, you know, how warm or cold it is. Mm. We can't change where it is. Mm. We can decorate up to a point, but we can't completely change the whole position of everything within our house. We're constantly thinking about, you know, what's that compromise between what we'd like to do mm-hmm. with what we can do, and the two big things there are going to be around money and time.
Right. And so, Matt, you know, really what I'm hearing in that is there's something about adapting to what we have.
Exactly, yeah.
And we, even within that, it's appreciating what we have. It might not be perfect. It might not be what we expected or hoped for. We were expecting a south-facing garden or different sorts of neighbours. And sometimes we have to let go of the struggle with wanting it to be a certain way versus appreciating and kind of managing what we have and enhancing exactly. what we have.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. And I think about, you know, we live in a place that's within walking distance of some places, which is wonderful. But in order to keep that mm-hmm. element of what for me is a very important part of my life, of not needing to get out and do everything in a car or on a bus or whatever, mm-hmm. Then with that goes the compromise of, you know, that you're surrounded by lots more people and mm-hmm. lots of other things there.
And certainly some of the children I've done this house analogy with, you know, one of the things they've talked about is, you know, what it's like not having a garden, having a leaky roof, you know, having to live in very cramped conditions, for example. And, you know, even despite all of the incredible hardships that some people have within their homes, they are still able to create, you know, the sanctuary that you've talked about, and to find within it their sense of self and their identity, or find nooks and crannies to appreciate what they have. And that can be very hard to do. Mm. So, Matt, thank you. And we can, you know, keep embellishing and going through this house. But I guess really ultimately what this house analogy is about is that it's you, is that it represents you. And if we were to go through this again,
yeah,
and to talk about each of those elements that we've discussed, but to talk about it in terms of you as a person, I wonder what, you know, should we do that now?
Would that let's do that. So this is an interesting.
Okay.
So again, just for those of you who are listening in, we've now got the house with lots of words written all around it, describing certain elements of what's going on.
So if you're considering that this home is actually you, what did it make you think of as you considered the foundation, Matt? You started with talking about the foundation being an important thing that gives mm-hmm. it stability, and it's a rock. So what gives you stability?
A very significant part of it comes from my family and my friends. And it's the people who make that work for me. I'm also in a very lucky situation in that I have a very stable job. So my work is something that, you know, in this last kind of year and a bit now, where some people have had, you know, significant challenges to deal with in terms of work. One of the things about working in education is that that's been pretty stable.
then more practically,
yeah.
what are the things that you have to do on a day-to-day basis or in the medium term that keeps your stability? So what is it that you have to do to take care of your foundation?
Absolutely. So for me, taking care of the foundations means reminding myself of what the habits are that mm-hmm. I've developed. For those who know me well, well, now I'm diabetic. So one of the things I have to be careful about is just thinking about my own health. So there are certain things that I have to do. So, for example, you know, I know that every single day I will go for a decent walk, regardless of the conditions, regardless of whether I've got time or not. And if it needs to be, I'll try and squeeze that in at the end of the day, even mm-hmm. if it means going out in the pitch dark, in the rain, mm-hmm. I will do it. Mm-hmm. And that those habits are there, and they are so important to me.
Yeah. And I'm pleased at what you said, which was I have to remind myself of the habits. I think that's really important, particularly when thinking about children, is that, you know, we all know exercise and eating well. We hear everybody say that often. Those are the key to building strong foundations. But sometimes they're really hard to maintain. And I think one of the key messages for children is that we all fall down within those, and we just have to re-remind ourselves of those as useful habits, as you've said, and to keep trying in our endeavour to keep our foundation solid rather than expecting that we will always stick to those good habits. When you look at this home and you're thinking about, we talked a lot about it being in an individual space. So how do you make sure that you are an individual, that you have your own sense of identity out in the world? Because one of the pitfalls we can have is, like we might compare our houses, we certainly compare ourselves to other people and to their successes or their strengths or what they look like. So how do you manage your sense of self out in the world?
What's interesting, of course, is it changes over time. And, you know, I'm now in a position where, you know, I've got teenage children, one of whom's off at university. So I've been working in education now for the best part of 30 years. And so in that time, I've kind of developed an understanding of myself that there are things that I know I love doing that within work, because I've worked really hard at them for a long, long time, and I'd like to hope that I'm doing them well. For me, there are key things in my life that I do that are nothing to do with work as well, and that's really important for me as well. So I'm a very keen musician. I still make a lot of music, and so that's a key element for me. It's a key social element for me as well. I would say that some of the very greatest friendships that I have been made through music, which is really, really important for me. You know, I am a creature of habit. I like to be an organized person. I feel calmer in myself when I feel in control.
Mm-hmm. And are there times when that gets in the way, Matt?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, really important. A part of how we understand who we are is that, you know, we call them strengths and weaknesses, but actually our weaknesses and our strengths can both be a double-edged sword in some ways, that our weaknesses can become our strengths and vice versa. And I think, you know, you said something really poignant early on, which is you're getting to know yourself. You've got to know yourself better. And using that knowledge and that reflection about what are my hobbies, what are my what do I get pulled into? I need organization, and that can make me feel calm, but equally that can be stressful because I need to do it all of the time. Okay. And so Matt, you know, we talked in terms of the house analogy about challenges, the weather conditions, things that we have no control over, the breakages, the repairs we might have to make, the noises around us. How does that apply to you? What challenges do you have to face that you have no control over, that any of us would have to face that we don't have control over?
One might be around my children. So my oldest child, who's at university, hasn't been at university since last December. And at the time of recording this, we're in a position where we're just finding out, you know, when she's going to be able to go back. Things that have been completely out of our hands dealing with that. My younger child, who's still at school, has had similar challenges to deal with as well. And that's completely out of our hands. As we go through there, it can be on a much smaller scale. So it could be, so, you know, I had grand plans to get my allotments up and running for this year, And it's been bitterly cold, and it's been below freezing every night for the last few days. So the idea of going in and planting stuff, I've had to change what I would like to do when it would be convenient for me, because it wouldn't be convenient, you know, in the long run. Actually, that's a classic example then, thinking about the foundations. The foundations for these little seeds that I'd be planting would be, they're going to need those basics. And if they're not getting the warmth straight away, and they're going to get frozen as soon as we put them in the ground, may well find that the rest of the year we don't get that growth. So I've got to kind of move it around from there. So you've got the tiny little things there. But of course, the one thing that I think everyone's really been dealing with, and kind of moving ourselves back to thinking about kind of general mental health, has been that we've been living on top of each other now for a year. And so finding space has been so, so important. Find, you know, even if that space is just a tiny little bit of one room at certain times of the day, or for those people who've got gardens, being able to go to the garden or being able to go out for that walk, that space is really, really important.
You know, within that, Matt, I guess I heard again is the idea of adapting. So when we don't have any control, like we haven't had particularly through COVID, and our levels of uncertainty have hit the roof, but our brains are desperate for plans, and we want to get out and do the things that we want to do. What you've shown just from the example of the allotment is that the constant need to adapt and change and manage our disappointment and find other ways to do the stuff that we want to do, even though the world might not always allow us a clear path. And I think children particularly face that lot in their early years. They have a lot of things to contend with and lots of changes and things to adapt to that they have no control over. So I think that's really important conversations to be had. Finally, because obviously again we could do this for a really long time, but just for some brevity, I guess, is how do you, you know, we talked about looking after this home, loving it, caring for it. You know, I talked to you about a young person saying that the house needed to be treated with respect. So how do you apply that to you? How do you have to treat yourself?
Probably at the heart of, for me, at least, at the heart of the decisions I make is I know that I have to look after my health. I know that if I don't look after my health, I could get quite poorly. I need to be thinking about that really in three ways. So the first way is in terms of what do I eat and when do I eat? The second thing is going to be how do I look after myself from a physical point of view? And the third thing is how I look after myself from a mental point of view. Whilst I love having space and calm, I also need to have engagements with other people. And so I need that. So I need my friends. I need my family. I need to be careful, particularly at the moment, to not continue to retreat the way that all of us have retreated at the moment. But I also need to be aware that there are certain triggers that I've developed to understand in myself that are warning signs. So for me, the number one thing I do is I share with my wife, and I talk with her. And when things aren't right, she'll be my number one person that I go to, and always has been. And that's vital that I've got that one person above all who I can go and talk with, and I can be completely frank and honest, and I can tell her when things feel really bad, as well as when things feel just okay or good or brilliant or whatever it is. But it's being able to talk about the really bad as well is so vital.
So really what you've described is so many layers to how we look after our mental health, look after ourselves. It's not just one clear thing that we have to do that suddenly solves everything. Yeah. There's different layers, isn't it? There's adapting, there's talking, there's pushing yourself a bit to do the thing that sometimes feels a bit uncomfortable, like doing more social things when we've actually all retreated a bit. Yeah. Equally, there's doing the mundane, boring things like organizing and tidying and eating well and looking after our physical stuff. We don't always want to, but we know we have to, as well as doing the beautiful things like music and hobbies and so on. So there's, I guess, I hope what this house starts to show you or show us is that there are many different aspects to how we self-care, and each of them need different attentions at different times, and that we will all confront challenges that try to wobble our houses. And sometimes our houses are already wobbly, And they're not perfect. And even within that, we're trying to find the small moments where we still continue that endeavor to look after ourselves within it, and treating, you know, treating you with respect, treating those around you with respect seems to really solidify your home.
Brilliant. So we've kind of looked in a lot of detail about how this particular model might well work as being a really effective approach that can be used to help children who've got potentially very significant mental health issues to deal with, but helping them to kind of bring it down to something that everyone can understand in their own way. But one of the things that we're getting up to now fairly soon for so many children is going to be the really significant transitions that start. So for people who are listening into the podcast when it first gets broadcast, this is going to be at the start of the summer term. And for everybody, we're going to be at that stage as this year goes on, whether we're trainee teachers moving on to our first early career jobs, whether we're children moving on to their new class or their new year, but obviously particularly as well thinking about those who are moving schools. So I'm just wondering now, are there any particular things that we can think about in terms of managing change?
What I'm hoping that this, if I start with the tool first of all, and then I'll come wider things, is I piloted this tool with two groups of year six students in Wolvercote and some older year groups in Forest Farm, and really just to facilitate these conversations about mental health to think about all those different elements that you and I've just talked about. And by doing the group, I mean, normally in my world I do individual work, but actually running it as a group, what that starts to generate is that sense of community, that sense that we're all in very similar boats when it comes to thinking about transition and change, that it does affect us all and it wobbles us in different ways, and some of us really show how we're wobbly and others of us don't show it, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening. And I think by facilitating more of these reflective conversations with young people, particularly at times of change, where they have a safe space to talk about what that's like, I think that can only really help enhance people's sense of belonging, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what the house analogy kind of shows us is having conversations about what we have control over and what we don't have control over. That's really important in terms of our agency. And I think often children can feel, particularly at moments of transition, that you should know all the answers by now and that you should be fine. Well, actually, you're not supposed to be fine, because this is new and your brain needs to process new things. And it's perfectly reasonable to have sleepless nights or to worry about things or to double check your bag, to worry about, you know, what other people are doing or that other people have got it better than you and so on. And I think, again, if we were to help children know that we all manage transitions in very similar ways, I think that would be really helpful for them. One of the tools I often give young people is how to worry helpfully, particularly about transitions. And so I often give children a structure to say things like, you know, well, can I solve the problem or the worry right now? So if the transition worry is, you know, going into secondary school, I don't know where the toilets are. Let's say that's poignant for this young person. Well, can they solve it right now in the middle of the night? Probably not. So if they can't, the next question then is, well, how do I solve it? Who do I need to ask somebody to help me with that? The answer might be, yes, I need to ask my teachers or somebody I know that's already in that secondary school. Maybe I need to wait until I have the induction day and then I'll find out. You know, it might be a worry that we can't solve, like, are the teachers strict or are they going to like me or am I going to be able to get all the work done in time? There's very big global worries that we know year sixes really worry about as they're moving up into secondary school. And so if there are worries that can't be solved, it's about learning to know where to park them, who they can go to. And so I guess I wondered whether, I don't know in schools whether you have a question and answer box, you know, questions that children can put in anonymously so they can ask these questions, or the myths that they have about secondary school. There's lots of myths, aren't they, that we follow and we think are true, or assumptions or kind of expectations that we have. And those are the things that create anxiety in the main.
Really, really good. Now, there are lots of really excellent pieces of material that you can access online to kind of support this. And I just really want to make sure that all our listeners are aware, particularly of a couple of things. So the first one is Mentally Healthy Schools, which is a free website. So that started off, so the Duchess of Cambridge launched with the Royal Foundation Heads Together with the Anna Freud Centre, and the Anna Freud Centre now runs Mentally Healthy Schools, but also with Young Minds and Place to Be. So we'll put in the show notes here some particular things in here, but they've got some great material all around transition and some practical tips for school staff to help children settle when they're starting primary school or changing schools regularly or making that transition to reception classes, but also that transition to secondary as well. So we'll put some links for those things there into the show notes so that people can have a look through those. But some really good things around there, around that. But as you say, sometimes it can be the practical things like having a question and answer box. And particularly if you're new to teaching, if you're an early career teacher and you're thinking about that, it's really important to do that kind of thing during this term, because when you get to those points, you may well have your own preconceptions about what you think children might be thinking about. Mm. And my goodness, sometimes you're right. And sometimes you're so wrong. And I'm really delighted, Naira, that you mentioned about the one about toilets for secondary school, because in my experience of working in primary schools, that was a big, big question. It was one that
can't underestimate it. No,
absolutely. And for some children, that would be something that would actually be overriding anything to do with how big the school might be, or where do I go, or I've got to move around from place to place for lessons.
Yeah, and I think children need to feel like that no question is daft, you know, that every question is essential and important to ask, you know. And you know, I've got a daughter who's in year five, and already she's starting to feel some of the anxiety from the year sixes, you know, and already saying things like the work's going to be too hard, or mummy, it's going to be so big and the teachers are really strict, and if you forget things you're going to get a detention, and you know, and it's amazing how the fear is slowly trickling down, because that's what we focus on, is the things that that we need to fix and sort, and the things that we need to worry about. And I think, you know, having these reflective spaces, either when, you know, if you're using the house analogy tool or not, or you're constantly talking to these transitional children, to have these focus group moments to go, right, where are we at, everybody? What are our new worries? These are some of the questions that have come through that we want to think about. This is what it was like for me, so that we can kind of try and make, where possible, the transition as seamless as we can, knowing that we're supposed to feel anxious in this, yeah, this moment.
But of course, the other thing to really consider is particularly if you're working in a school, is actually also not just to focus on the potential anxieties, but also to think about those wonderful opportunities that are going to be there, and trying to have that flip side of so that when you're going home at the end of a day, if you've been reflecting on this at primary school, for example, that as well as thinking about the things that you can be feeling more relieved about because you've got answers to your anxieties, but you've also got that kind of reminder that there are some wonderful opportunities there as well.
Yeah. I often say to children to go into a new space with curiosity rather than with just the expectations, and to go, what's it going to be like? What is the library like? What's the smell going to be like of this new space?
One final aspect of this, just before we finish for today. Although we're talking about every child, there will be some children who will need a little bit more support than others. And so it's really important to bear in mind that as a trainee teacher, that you need to be having those conversations, particularly if you're working in, for example, in year six in primary school. If you're working with children there, is having those conversations about what are we going to be doing to help to make this transition work for people who may well need more support than others. And I know that you've done a lot of work in the past working with more vulnerable children, and that will certainly have included those transition moments.
It's a very big question, Matt, and hard to, you know, to really know for sure who's going to struggle and who won't in transitions. You know, and I think there's different layers here. So, you know, you may have at one end the very high achieving young person who appears to be doing really well, super confident, who are actually worried about the workload and being good enough. So there is that layer, as well as your the other end of things, your super vulnerable children that are on the sense register already, that we know may well have a traumatic background, for example, and have very many needs. And so there's different approaches at different levels, you know. And I think also thinking about those children that have social skills deficits who are going to be worried about how they socialize into things. So, you know, you've got a lot of work as early years teachers to be thinking about that. And I guess my advice would be is the more you know about a young person's background as much as you're allowed to know your class makeup is what's going to be really important, so that you can tailor whether or not, say, for example, the house analogy, do you do it as a group? Do you do it individually? Do you do it at all? Is it a safe thing to do? The struggles really depend very much on the expectations that that young person has about the transition and change, previous experiences of change. So asking children about that. What was it like when you changed and moved to nursery? What was it like when you moved home? So that you have a sense of what that was like for that individual, that we have a collective experience but also an individual experience. We said already about the assumptions and myths that might exist and helping to break those down. And to break down one of those myths right now, it is the issue about referring into CAMHS or about using CAMHS services and children's mental health services well. And I've just had a conversation yesterday with the head of the InReach service for schools. And what she said to me was, you know, please encourage teachers to not feel afraid to contact CAMHS, even if it's just for a question. They're not just there for high end referrals. They're also there to help advise you to know what's out there. So use them usefully. They have an absolute wealth of knowledge. Sometimes they'll just want to give you some advice over young people. Sometimes they want to signpost you to things. There's so many new things up and coming, particularly at the early years, actually. And there's a lot more InReach work that's coming about in the next year, as far as I'm understanding. So I guess in a nutshell, what I'm saying is it's not one size fits all, as I'm sure your teachers know perfectly well. And one of the art or the dance that teachers have to do constantly on a day-to-day basis is knowing how to pitch their learning with those that have the most vulnerability to those that are, you know, functioning incredibly well but will still potentially have some worries. And that dance is really, really hard to do. And I guess it's really knowing your safeguarding policies. It's using, just like you said in the house analogy, Matt, having a mentor, somebody to talk to, somebody to share the concerns with, and being as informed as possible about what the young person's background is.
Brilliant. Naira, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure as always.
Okay. Brilliant, Matt. Really good fun. Thank you.
Thank you.